Monster Man, episode 438, Mudman and Mummy.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through Monsters Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, 2nd edition. Before we get started, a quick reminder, A Folklore Bestiary is still on Kickstarter. You can go ahead and back it now. It's got a bunch of great monsters designed by various RPG luminaries and also me. Plus, you can pick up a copy of the Budget Bestiary at the link in the show notes. I was hoping to be able to announce that Magonian Mind Murders is available for retail sale, but a couple of the things that I need to do before that happens got a bit delayed by me being sick, but hopefully by the end of this month. Okay, let's start by taking a look at the Mudman. I don't have very much to say about them that I haven't said already, and I don't think that I said all that much about them the first time around. These are creatures from Monster Manual 2. They're created when magical water sources flow into, you know, muddy ponds or whatever. So if you have some kind of magical pool or spring, if that water kind of stands and soaks into the earth, it'll create Mudmen. I seem to remember these guys being in the D&D cartoon, but when I look it up, I can't find them, so it is possible that I'm just thinking of a similar muddy monster in a different cartoon. Possibly in Dragon's Lair. I don't know what the deal is with the Dragon's Lair cartoon. It may just be like footage from the game, but I remember it being on television when I was a kid. I never really played Dragon's Lair very much, although there was a Dragon's Lair machine in the arcade at the movie theater in my hometown. Or that I went to as a kid, actually. When you grow up in the suburbs, your hometown is kind of a meaningless concept. I come from a suburban smear dozens of miles long. But anyway, yeah, Mudmen are a good concept, and they're executed pretty effectively. Like several other monsters in this book, they do have a bespoke-to-hit system, which from a kind of system purism perspective is a little annoying, although in practice I don't think it makes all that much of a difference, because they needed a system to represent the fact that someone chucking a glob of mud at you, like, you will not be protected by the fact that you're wearing armor. You know, the question is, does the glob hit you or no? And armor makes you harder to hit, or it doesn't, it's awkward. But anyway, another bespoke AC system, but since we're just carrying around one page of this book that has all the rules we need on it, that's fine. It would almost be more frustrating if we had to look up a special system for ignoring certain types of armor to hit people with certain types of attacks. Next up, we have the Mummy, and I'm going to combine this with the Mummy comma Greater. Your mummy that's not greater is basically a, you know, shambling brute. Your mummy comma Greater is intelligent and can cast spells. They're typically, you know, priests of some pseudo-Egyptian or Egyptian-themed religion. Typically kind of like entombed, you know, charged with defending the pyramid of some kind of high priest or monarch. Can it be possible that I haven't talked about the structure of archaeological horror yet? I searched through the show's back catalog trying to find a mummy or archaeological horror episode. This is kind of the problem. I think I've done about 600 episodes by this point. I know this is only episode 438, but I don't number the specials, which in retrospect was a mistake. My point is simply that archaeological horror is something that I think about a lot, and I must have done, because I'm pretty sure I re-uploaded the episode of my old podcast, Pledge Break, in which we talked about Tomb of the Cybermen, which is essentially a mummy story. Anyway, to summarize, archaeology horror often includes this kind of metaphorical connection between death and the past and secrets and the unconscious mind. When we talk about things that are better left buried, we may mean things better left buried in the memory, in the past, or we may mean, you know, literally buried in the ground. And an anxiety about digging up those things, about what exactly it is the archaeologists do, is common because there are lots of things in the past, in the land of the dead, under the ground, and in the unconscious mind, or in sleep, which is another aspect of that metaphor, that we would not like to see literally or metaphorically unearthed. And in particular, I think there's some anxiety about mummies connecting this to the notion of colonialism, because the boom in popular interest in, you know, mummies and Tutankhamun and all that stuff in the 1920s occurs around the time that Egypt is becoming independent of Britain. Although I realize that the political relationship between Britain and Egypt is very complicated, but that'll do for a summary. Anyway, for instance, you know, the example I always use is the Hammer mummy, in which you kind of have to agree that the villain has a point, and Peter Cushing is not portrayed in a very sympathetic light, and you really do think of him as being kind of punished for his hubris by this monster. That is a pretty characteristic feature of mummies, and it's not something that you could say for instance, Dracula. The mummy kind of has a point. People are disturbing his eternal slumber, and he comes from a culture and a faith to whom that is very important. It's not like the uppermost thing in my mind, but I do feel a twinge of guilt when I see mummies in museums. Like, these were people for whom being buried in a way where they would be preserved was the most important thing they could think of, and look how it worked out for them. The ethics of the display of human remains in museums, actually quite a complicated subject, and A, not one that I intend to get into here, B, not one that's likely to come up in a D&D game, but I do think that the consciousness of that fact lends a little frisson to the mummy. On a scale of Dracula to the Wolfman, the mummy is somewhere in the middle in terms of being sympathetic. Now, this entry mentions Ankhtepot. Ankhtepot is the sort of mummy equivalent to Strahd in the Ravenloft setting, right? So if Strahd stands in for Dracula in the Ravenloft setting, then Ankhtepot stands in for Imhotep, I guess, right? He is the sort of mummy overlord. And he has a whole mummy family, and he has a group of mummies, comma, greater, whom he sort of created using his magic. They're like his priests. It says, actually, you know, even in this entry, it says that mummies, comma, greater, need not necessarily be of evil alignment. Like, if it so happens that someone who was good aligned is turned into a mummy, comma, greater, they just retain all their powers and things and, you know, continue to cast spells from their gods and so forth. But I guess the thing about Ankhtepot is that that is not the kind of person that he is likely to turn into a mummy, comma, greater, right? Because creating this undead creature is an evil act. So therefore, the type of people who do it are typically not the type of people who would choose, you know, principled and high-minded individuals to turn into mummies, comma, greater, except perhaps as some kind of curse or sick joke. But I do like that that puts the mummy, comma, greater into the space of a monster with whom you could potentially negotiate, because it isn't necessarily evil. So when you encounter one, you know, in its throne room or its shrine or rummaging through its endless pigeonholes of scrolls, you can have a talk with it before you get into a big magic fight. And I think that that's always desirable. This is an example of one of those monsters that is strongly tied to a set of aesthetics that don't necessarily make very much sense within its fantasy context, but from which it cannot be divorced, because that's kind of the whole deal of the monster. Those are always fun to see. There's so much more reading I have to do on the history of mummy horror, because there's actually a lot out there, but I went to a conference once that really whetted my appetite for it, but there was supposed to be a second one, but, you know, I guess life intervened. Anyway, that is about all I have to say about the mummy and mummy, comma, greater. They are classics, they are good, they kind of come with a story automatically, so that's also nice, and people like it, right? I think, like, people like to be in the mummy's tomb, and they like when the, you know, the guide tells them that the excavators have stopped work because they say this place is cursed, Effendi. I think people like that kind of thing. And so I think a good mummy is a popular villain. You don't have too many of them. It does kind of make them less special. All right. That is about all the monsters that we have time for today. In our next episode, well, actually, at this point, it's not clear what the schedule is like. We may be doing a My Favorite Monster episode about the Folklore Bestiary, or we may be talking about monstrous babies. We'll see how that goes. But either way, it's going to be a good time right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.